Hungry for spicy food and even hotter conversations? Craving community and authentic storytelling? Then join the table. This is Minor Legends, a new comedy fiction podcast supported by Potluck. Pull up every week with me, Angela Wong Carbone, and follow the stories of me and my friends as we serve up tasty tales of what it means to be Asian American at our weekly dinner hang. If you enjoy deep dishing on absurd stereotypes like tiger moms who tutor your dating game rather than grades, the insanity of your parents' immigration story, to the legend of that one good Asian cousin you can never live up to, then pull up a seat and grab a plate. Featuring dinner guests like Ronnie Chang, Brian Park, Usama Siddiqui, Celia Au, Perry Young, Supriya Ganesh, and more. It's a tasty rotation that'll leave you belly laughing and steeped in relatable and spicy conversations. Can you take the heat? Listen now for free wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to
Whoa!
Potluck.
And welcome to Books and Boba, a book club and podcast featuring books by Asian and Asian American authors. My name is Marvin Yue.
And I'm Rira Yu.
And we are here today to discuss our August 2025 book club pick, The Wangs vs. the World by Jay Chang. As always, Books and Boba is supported in part by our listeners. So if you've been enjoying our podcast and want to become a bigger part of our book club, head on over to patreon.com/booksandboba, where as an official Patreon supporter, you gain access to our members-only Discord server where you can chat with us and fellow book club members about our book club picks and other topics in real time. And if you join us at the Honey Boba level, you also gain access to our monthly bonus podcast Boba Chats, as well as gain the opportunity to help us pick a quarterly book club pick to read for the podcast. Our next patron's choice will be our October spooky read. So if you join now, you can help us pick which Asian American spooky book we'll be reading this year. But yeah, Rira, we've made it to the end of August. How are you feeling about the year? So it's been quite a few weeks. We don't have to delve right into, like, if you want to hear more of our opinions and thoughts about the state of the world, you can join our Patreon and tune into our Boba Chats where Rira and I, it's just been a lot of what we've been talking about the last few months.
I don't want to talk about the state of the world in our Honey Boba book club episodes, because I just want to talk about fun things, but the world just keeps churning in the wrong direction. And it's not fun living in this timeline. But Marvin did the book news episode solo last week because I was not around, because I was in the East Coast. I was in Pennsylvania to celebrate my wedding that happened almost a year ago.
Yeah.
Because I have like a wedding tour. So I had my elopement. I had my L.A. Wedding reception back in February, and then I had my Korean reception in April, and then we closed out with our August wedding reception with most of Dan's family, because they're like mostly all based in the East Coast, so it was a lot of Dan's family there, but my friends came along with me, so it wasn't too much of like I'm being thrown into the shark waters and have to like socialize with everyone. It felt a little bit better to have people who had my backs there. Yeah. So now I'm back and I'm so glad that I don't have to celebrate my wedding with other people anymore. I'm so glad it's done.
You finished your wedding tour of duty. Welcome to married life for reals now.
Like I said, it's been almost a year now since I eloped.
Yeah.
So, and people saying like, "Oh, congratulations to the bride." I'm like, I don't feel like a bride. I'm a wife. I've been a wife for I've been with my partner for 14 years at this point. So really, it doesn't. Yeah.
Yeah. And listeners to our Boba Chess episode will know that Rira's worldwide travels have been an ordeal. And so if you're curious to hearing more about what that means, you can do so by joining us on Patreon and listening to our past Boba Chat episodes. But yeah, looking forward
Let me just say, I have been cursed this year by the travel gods, because every single flight I've been on, there's been an issue. It's either been canceled or delayed significantly, or they rebook me on a layover where I don't get to my destination until like 1 a.m. So yeah, it's been great. Yeah. I hope I don't get on a plane anytime soon. I would like to end 2025 without being on a plane and hope this curse goes away by 2026.
Well, I'm curious to hear more about your trip for our next Boba Chat episodes, because I don't actually know what happened to you this time, but eager to find out.
I mean, nothing really bad happened. I'm just saying that, like, travel-wise, it seems to be the case for everyone. Like, air travel is not as reliable as it once was, so it hasn't just been me. If you guys have been traveling by air, like, please, like, chime in on our Discord, because I would love to hear other people's travel stories. Travel horror stories, because it would make me feel better. So please share on our Discord if you guys are a part of that.
Yeah. Speaking of travel stories, we read a road trip story this time around. And I guess before we get into it, just a quick standard spoiler warning that we will be discussing The Wangs versus the World in its entirety, meaning all plot points, all character beats, and any plot spoilers are on the table. So if you do care about being spoiled about those things and you have not finished the book yet, here's your opportunity to hit pause and come back when you have finished the book. But I guess to kick off our discussion of our book club pick, Mira, can you start us off, as always, with the book jacket description of The Wangs versus the World?
Charles Wang, a brash, lovable businessman who built a cosmetics empire and made a fortune, has just lost everything in the financial crisis. So he rounds up two of his children from schools that he can no longer afford and packs them into the only car that wasn't repossessed. Together with their wealth-addicted stepmother, Barbara, they head on a cross-country journey from their foreclosed Bel Air home to the upstate New York retreat of the eldest Wang daughter, Sina. And that's a pretty short description for a pretty hefty book, because this book is around 355 pages. Wangs versus the World came out in October 2016. I know this because this was my first book of the month purchase, and book of the month is a book subscription service. We're not sponsored, by the way. We were sponsored a long time ago, but it's a book subscription service that usually has like books packaged before the official release date, and you usually get to read the book like a couple of weeks before it hits the shelves, because it's like produced on cheaper paper. But it says October 2016 on here. And this book was really highly acclaimed. It was a New York Times book review editor's choice. It was an October 2016 indie new pick. And it was on a bunch of most anticipated book lists back in 2016.
Yeah. And like, yeah, our podcast started on September 28th, 2016. So like,
yeah, I was just about to mention that. Yeah. Yeah. Like, we are almost as old as, no, we are older.
We were like a few days older. Yeah. Like maybe a month older.
Yeah. 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 And I remember, like, this was the first book that I bought through the Book of the Month subscription service. And I read the first 100 pages, and then somehow I just stopped. I think I may have been like preoccupied with reading other stuff. Whether it was for this book club or several other book clubs I was a part of at that time, because I was really just gung-ho in my reader era. And yeah, like visiting this book again almost like 10 years later, I'm just like, I can see why I stopped at the 100-page mark. And I wonder if my opinion of the book would have been different if I had finished it in 2016, because I feel like the Asian American literature landscape has changed quite a bit since then. What about you, Marvin?
So this book has been on my to be read lists since the beginning of our book club. Like we mentioned, we are almost as old. We're older than this book, but we just never had a chance to, because back then I think we were trying to stay away from new books for our book club, just to, you know, keep things I guess affordable for our book club members. And you know, it was a book that we were always going to read later, or in my mind, we're going to read later for the book club. And then, you know, almost 10 years later, we're like, well, thinking about like a book to read for August, which is like the end of the summer season. If like a road trip book is kind of like a summer type of story, right? So I think that's why the book came back into our orbit. And also because we might be talking with Jade later this year, too, about her latest book. So I figured this would be a good time to, you know, check out her debut. And I know we had a little pre-chat on the Discord, and I know Rira and I will have, it's going to be another one of those episodes where Rira and I have differing opinions on the book. I actually really enjoyed it. I think part of it is because, you know, though my family is not super wealthy, we do share a lot of cultural touch points with the Wang family. I think a lot of the cultural touch points really endeared me to them. And I'm also a big fan of books about dumb rich people, or stories about dumb rich people, like Arrested Development, stories about rich people who will suddenly become not rich anymore, having to deal with it, is kind of funny. And one thing that I noticed right away is, like, reading the description of the book, I had imagined this to be like a take on, like, say, Crazy Rich Asians. But what took me by surprise is, like, the Wang family here, they're not Crazy Rich Asians rich. They're actually the type of rich people that the Youngs of Crazy Rich Asians will, like, look down their nose on, because they're, like, nouveau riche, right? And Charles is definitely, like, one of those, you know, more, he's a crude guy. He's, like, the type of rich person who, like, likes to flaunt and likes to, like, you know, be brash. And so I thought that was a really funny take on these characters, especially in the era where, actually, not even, because 2016 is before the Crazy Rich Asians craze and everyone started.
No, it's not. It's not. I looked this up before we started this podcast because I had, like, I have my opinion about this, but Crazy Rich Asians, the book, came out in 2014. Mm. And it was like a pretty, like, it was a cultural shift. Okay. And then 2018 was when the movie came out.
Yeah.
And that's when it was like a cultural reset. And that's where we get the flux of Asian American stories in mainstream platforms.
Yeah. I guess my point is, like, Crazy Rich Asians ushered in a new era of, like, let's talk about stories about old money rich people. Let's talk about, like, the extravagances of, like, people who just, like, are born into generational wealth and things like that, where I feel like the Wang family is like kind of the anti that, right? They're still rich, like, richer than you and me, right? But they're not, like, their money does not come from, like, generational land, right? Or not anymore, because
generational history, right? Wealth, where it's like three generations of just really, really wealthy families just passing it on. It's not like they own, like, hotels in, like, every continent, you know. Like, they're like Beverly Hills rich, which isn't like billionaire rich.
Yeah. And so right off the bat, though, that first chapter I think set the tone pretty well. I really love that it was like, it felt like a take, I don't know, like, I don't remember when Pachinko came out. Like, Pachinko came out about the same time, right? 2016, 2017, like?
I think 2017, but let me check, because this is very important. Yes, it came out in February 7th, 2017.
Okay.
So really, like, pretty much 2016, if you think about it, because it's, like, early 2017. Yeah.
And I thought it was really funny, reading this after Pachinko, how, like, the opening chapter from Charles's point of view is basically Minjin Lee's famous "History Has Failed Us," but, like, a reverse Uno version, where it's like, history has failed me and I will make it pay, right?
Yeah. Like, I'll read, like, the first paragraph, because I do think that this book started off really strong with the first chapter. Charles Wang was mad at America. Actually, Charles Wang was mad at history. If the death-bent Japanese had never invaded China, if a billion misguided students and serfs had never idolized a balding academic who parroted Russian madmen and couldn't pay for his promises, then Charles wouldn't be standing here, standing out the window of his beloved Bel Air home, holding an aspirin in his hand, waiting for those calculating assholes from the bank that had once gotten down on its Italianate marble knees and kissed his ass, to come over and repossess his life. Without history, he wouldn't be here at all. And really, really sets the tone for what kind of rich man he is.
What kind of man
he is.
Woe is
me.
Right? Yeah.
Yeah.
And, like, the fact that, like, he is endlessly ambitious. He says, oh, I should be very cultured, but like, he's a very crude man. He's like your prototypical, like when you think of like arrogant patriarchal Chinese man, you think Charles Wang is like that model.
Yeah. And just the fact that like he has this longing to take back what is his in China, like he's like obsessed with his ancestral land because he was like, I come from a family of scholars and like, you know, the bourgeoisies and like, yeah. I like this belongs to me and the communists took it all. And honestly, I don't think he actually thought about taking it back until he lost it all in America. So China has become his new American dream.
Yeah.
In a way.
Charles Wang is someone who's always trying to get his nut, right? He just wants... He wants his bag. If he loses his, he'll figure out another way to get it. Which does, like, you know, come back towards the end, too. We can talk about, like, the ending, because a lot of our book club members have questions about, like, the kind of metaphorical nature of the end of this book. But definitely, like, Charles is always thinking about, okay, I may have lost everything, but I haven't lost everything. There's always a chance. Like, he is, like...
He's a businessman.
He's a businessman, like, but also a gambler. Like, but his gambling currency is business ideas and like assets, right?
Yeah,
yeah.
Yeah. I do like how he got the idea to start his cosmetics empire, which is like his family or like distant family. They worked in like urea factories, which is pretty much like piss.
It's a chemical found in piss that's used in a lot of things.
Okay,
right?
Yeah, that's what I meant. But like he crudely calls it piss. So yeah. That's just kind of what I related it with. But he's on his airplane to America. He's getting plane sick, and he like in the bathroom he pulls out the bar of soap that's there. And he's like reading the ingredients and it says urea on it. And he was like, oh, okay. So this really cheap chemical that I have access to in Taiwan, like I can probably use those connections to make cosmetics because he wants to make beautiful things in this beautiful country, Megua or Miguk or
yeah.
America, however you say it in your Asian tongue. But I thought that was a really good, what do you call it? Like a good allegory, you know?
Yeah, it's also a very like it's a very Chinese / Taiwanese thing, which is like, okay, I want to make money. I know I can't make the things they make in America, right? I don't have the technical expertise, but I can make the things that go into those things and make money that way. And that's kind of how Taiwan made its like economic fortune in like the 80s and 90s, and how China, you know, was able to catch up economically in the 90s and 2000s, which is like, we're going to make the parts that go into your iPhones or go into your computers. And in a lot of ways, Taiwan still makes almost everything that goes into our computers and smartphones. And so it's like, it's a very like, you know, we think of business like successful business people as like, you know, the Steve Jobs or like, you know, for better words, the Zuckerbergs or other people that we don't like anymore. But the real people that make money are the people that own the land that they build on, who own like the raw materials production and like, you know, who makes the semiconductors and in a lot of ways, who makes like the fake pee that goes into all of our cosmetics, our soaps, our makeup and things like that. And so it's a very like, it's a quick and dirty way to kind of show us like, this is how people get rich, by like finding something that people need, right?
Okay. So I said this on the Discord. I did not like this book. and I think partially it's due to how it was marketed, because a lot of magazines and like book reviewers, they were saying how this was an outrageously funny book. So I kind of expected it to be, I mean, people compared it to Crazy Rich Asians because there was really nothing to compare it to at this time. And Crazy Rich Asians was a very ridiculous book. And Arrested Development and Schitt's Creek, they're also sitcoms with ridiculous people who are just kind of over the top. And I just feel like that didn't meet my humor expectations. And I think this book really should have been marketed as a satirical family, like, road trip drama, because the comedy wasn't as, like, hard-hitting for me. So that, like, I feel like that definitely influenced my opinion on this book. Also, like, it was just too long for me. I feel like the middle sagged quite a bit. For a book that's like 355 pages, I was like, okay, I think we could have cut out quite a bit, or we could have replaced a lot of the POV chapters with more, like, destinations throughout their trip. I kind of expected more road trip shenanigans. I was picturing a very different book from what Jade wrote, and that's not her fault. But I did feel like the pacing did drag, and I know it was the point of the book because it's a road trip, and like they don't know where they're going in terms of like how are they going to live after they reach upstate New York. So it's like they're kind of in an aimless emotional journey, and I get that, but I just felt like it was a little too aimless because it felt like I was in a road trip where I'm like, where are we going? Are we there yet? I really hate the people who are in the car with me, and so I need to take a break.
So you probably did relate to the car itself, which got its own set of
POV chapters. Yeah, the sentient car chapter was great. I wish there was more POV chapters of the car. RIP car, because the car pretty much gets destroyed
near the end of
the book. Yeah, what a real one. Mercedes 1970 something. I don't know what year the car came out.
You know, okay, like, I know explicitly it said it was a Mercedes station wagon, but in my mind, it was a Volvo. I don't know why, but in my mind, they were just in a Volvo.
Is it because of Little Miss Sunshine? Maybe. Because this is also a book that reminds me of Little Miss Sunshine.
Probably. I think that's what keeps popping in my head. That's interesting. So I actually came in with not a lot of expectations because I don't think I read that it was like Schitt's Creek meets Little Miss Sunshine. But in my mind, it was like, this is a road trip story about like people who lost it all. So I think in terms of that, like in terms of like, without the expectation of being like a uproarious time, it did hit a lot of the like my expectations for the book. And I actually, you know, I am someone who does enjoy both road trip like movies and also just taking road trips in general. So I actually didn't mind the like interstitials while they were on like the I-10, like kind of thinking about the past. And I do agree that like there's a lot of this book is told, like there's a lot of flashbacks, right? Because we learn the backgrounds, histories of every single character. But I also thought those are pretty fascinating. I think what really impressed me about the book is, and I think what makes like one of these like Schitt's Creek's alikes work is, as the story goes on, I did find myself, and I know your mileage may vary, like because some of our readers, some of our book club readers did not have this experience, but like I found myself being more and more endeared to the Wang family as time went on. Like at first glance, they're all terrible. And at the end of the book, they're also kind of terrible people, but they're like, I understand them more. And so I like, sympathize with them more, and they seem like, okay, like they're privileged assholes, but they're not like malicious. Like they're not like malignantly bad.
See, the thing is, I kind of wish they were more like assholes, you know? Like in the beginning, it's just like, okay, Charles, like he's very crude and, you know, he's the typical like nouveau riche Asian man who's like siding with white supremacy because that's like a proximity to power and all that. But I'm like, the kids needed to be bigger assholes. Like I expected like way more pretentiousness and way more bad decisions. So like because of like my expectations for them to be extremely big assholes when it comes to like their rich pretentiousness, like the way they were presented, I'm like, oh, they're not that bad. And then as the book kept going on, I'm like, I mean, are they becoming better people? Not really. And that's okay with me, but I wish like their bad decisions were more entertaining to me. So that's kind of how I felt about their
I mean, I think the worst decisions come from Charles himself, who is like a, you know, he's an ideas factory. And like when you have a ton of ideas, half of them are going to be bad ideas. And like his attempt to reclaim his family land, you know, I can see it as like it's an act of desperation. Very naive, but also it almost worked, you know, if it wasn't for his, you know, his family's, his like extended family's own greed. And it's kind of poetic. And we can get to this when we get to that part where like he was done in, like this greedy man was done in by a greedy relative.
Another greedy man, yeah.
But like the only other person that really made bad decisions was kind of Sina. I mean, Andrew made bad decisions, but it comes from just him being a dumbass. I feel like Gracie, and we can talk about Gracie and her issues. But I feel like Sina, reading Sina's chapters really reminded me of our, I think it was our May or June book club pick Blob, where it's like just a woman who's just making bad love decisions and also fell in love with like, because, okay, so her story is about how she's kind of hiding from the art world. And we can talk about her whole art thing, because I think that's another conversation. But like she got caught in a scandal, was essentially exiled from the New York art scene, and is hiding out in a country cottage in like Helios, New York, which is upstate. And then she like she's dating a local farmer, but ends up getting back with her like asshole artist boyfriend, Grayson, who like reading Grayson's chapters and reading Grayson's like description, he's pretty much like what the endpoint would be for the Blob Man in Blob, in my mind. Like, he is just like, he's the amalgamation of like what people think they want out of like a partner, an artistic partner, but also like just like he's nothing.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, he's like the typical like attractive white, conventionally attractive white man who, you know, is kind of like representing what success is when it comes to like people of color in like their love lives. And it's like, oh yeah, he's quote unquote charming. I don't think he's charming. He's quote unquote sensitive because he's an artist. He's successful. And I did find it really, really ironic and interesting that he pretty much cheats on Sina for Sabrina, who is like pretty much like, imagine like Sabrina Carpenter, you know, like this blonde, like this beautiful blonde lady who is from like, you know, who's also from a rich family, but like an old money rich family, and who has like connections to like the upper echelons of like high society. So he's just like, yeah, I don't love her, but I love what she does for me. And that's kind of what Sina's relationship with Grayson was. So it's like, yeah, it is just funny how the white trophy went after another white trophy.
Yeah. It was interesting that like it feels like all three of the Wang children are creatives, right? Sina is a fine artist, Andrew
conceptual
is a,
artist, yeah. Yeah,
Andrew is a comic, and Gracie is, I guess, a fashion blogger, which is, I guess, adjacent influencer in 2016 terms, right?
Yeah, exactly. This isn't set in 2016. This is set in 2008.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, exactly. So before the advent of like 2008 was when the iPhone like came out, right?
Like, okay, like to give people like a timeline, I guess. BuzzFeed didn't really take off until 2010. So think about that. Yeah, in terms of like social influence. So Grace was kind of a pioneer in terms of like capitalizing on her style and not writing like articles. She literally was Instagram before Instagram became a thing.
I mean, blogs were the thing in like 2008. Blogs, Zangas, LiveJournal. That era of social media, but
she didn't write though. It's just pictures.
So more Tumblr. Was Tumblr around 2008?
Yeah, I guess. Yeah, yeah. Tumblr was definitely like late 2000s to mid 2000s. It's quite funny because I'm on Threads quite a lot, and people talk about how a lot of people are stealing jokes from Tumblr that was like made in 2013, and it's like Tumblr, yeah. The OG, like, creative space.
Yeah, it's where you went to develop.
And now everything is just a copy.
Yeah, it's where you went to develop your online personality, really.
Yeah, yeah.
But it did, like, I did have a chuckle thinking that, like, Charles Wang, this, like, prototypical Chinese immigrant father, has three creative children. But at least he has, like, one of each, right? He has a highbrow artist and a lowbrow artist, right, between Sina and Andrew. As someone who is, I think, more familiar with, like, the art scene, what did you think about Sina's art?
Really, it reminded me why I don't like conceptual art. And it reminded me of, like, my old days of, like, back in college where I had to go to galleries and, like, you know, write, like, 10-page papers on, like, a performance artist or a conceptual artist. And I'm like, I just feel like these people are just doing shit just for the sake of doing shit. It's, like, very much like stand-up comedy in a way, but more highbrow. And it's like, I don't like it. And I think the people who are making it don't even know what they're saying. And they're using the audience and their perceptions as part of the art, you know? It's just like, well, what do you think my art says? And it's just, I don't know, it just feels so much like a cop-out to me as someone who, you know, is more in, like, the film space. And, you know, like, it's, anyway, it yeah. just reminded me of how much bullshit the upper class is just admired in when it comes to the art scene. Like, you see them as tastemakers, but really, like, they have no taste. And it's, everything is just spectacle. And I'm like, I don't know. What is the point?
That's true, because, like, what gets around the map is a very, like, spectacle, like, was it even, like, live art performance art? It's like she put jackets of her face on homeless people, which, saying that out loud, sounds very icky, right?
It is icky. The whole time it was very icky.
Yeah.
And the reason why she has, like, the audacity to do that, because let's face it, it is a horrible thing to do. Because you're just treating homeless people as
props,
you know,
yeah,
like business cards, which is, you know, kind of vulgar. And that was the whole point of her art project. But she gets the idea because she is working as, like, an intern or, like, one of the assistants for like a Chinese artist, Ladders to Heaven. I forgot the actual name of the piece, but it's an actual piece of work. Mm-hmm. It's where they use fireworks to,
yeah,
to
I've
form
seen
a
these
ladder
pieces
going to the sky.
When I was in China, like, they look pretty cool.
Yeah. And, like, I know recently they did, like, a successful launch into the sky. Like, it was, like, a perfect installation, which doesn't happen that often. And the creator, he made it for his grandmother, who was, you know, like, on her way to passing. So,
yeah.
Anyway, this is a real piece of art. And she works on it and she realizes how big of an asshole most of the people who are in charge of her tasks are. And they're usually men. And she's like, well, if they're not afraid to be assholes and not afraid to take up space and to speak up, then I should just be an asshole. And that's where she gets the idea to,
yeah,
to do, like, spectacle, crude art projects.
Kind of just in-your-face type of art projects. And, you know, she gains a lot of notoriety and a lot of fame. Like, this is her second or third one where she's, like, taking images from, like, Tiananmen and, like, you know,
made it into a fashion show.
Yeah. And, like, I think, you know, she thinks, like, she's hit on a thing. And I think it's a pretty good, like, you know, the underlying art is, like, exploitative, but the satire of, like, the art world's reaction to it is very, like, it sounds familiar. It feels familiar as people who worked adjacent to Asian American media, because, like, yeah, when you're talking about your own people's suffering and struggle, you're, like, lauded for it. But the moment you step out of that lane, like, you become a target, right? And that's kind of what she does in her, like, last art piece, where she starts talking about Palestine and things like that. And she, all of a sudden, she's, like, out of line. She's exploiting tragedies and all that. When she was actually kind of doing that the entire time.
I mean, she was always doing that. But, like, this time it kind of crossed the line because like pretty much her last project, The Scandal, was she took pictures from like National Geographic, New York Times of like women, beautiful women and girls who are in like war-torn countries. And it's like a commentary on how the West kind of exoticizes and sexualize girls and women who are victim to war and just kind of like beautifying it. And I'm like, yeah, that is like a good commentary. But she took those images and made them into runway models. And her whole thing is like, what if these beautiful women were noticed just for their beauty and not like tied to their circumstances? What if they had like the opportunities that models in New York City have? And it's like, I mean, but also that's minimizing.
Yeah.
The world conflicts that they were in. And, you know, a lot of these beauties, so-called beauties, they died or, you know, like an example is there was like this very famous cover of an Afghanistan girl with like green eyes. And like I remember at the time it was like such a big deal. Like people were like imitating this type of headshot. And there was an article that came out a couple of years ago, like tracking like, where is she now? What is she doing? Who is this woman? And she went through a really hard life. And actually, like this portrait, like made her life harder because of like religious reasons and like how like her face shouldn't have been shown to like a male foreigner So there's a lot of complications, and I just feel like Saint Sina was not really thinking.
No,
and
she
that's
had a
what
good,
people caught on to.
Yeah, I mean, she had a good idea, and then she kind of made a wrong turn halfway through. Like she chose the worst way to go about that idea, and I thought it was interesting because, yeah, like conceptually, she may have not done anything different. She kind of just was expanding on like what her themes of already are, but just like the art world itself is like, okay, this is too far. Like, you can't talk about other people like this. You can't, like, you know, or now that people are complaining to us, like, now we have to cancel you, right? And that's essentially what happened to her. She got canceled, and then she ran away.
Yeah. Yeah. I kind of wish, I mean, like, the Tiananmen Square fashion show, I kind of wish that was the scandal that made her disappear. Because I feel like that would have been a good commentary on how, even though she is Chinese American, like, you know, she's so far removed from the tragedy that happened in China, and also like her economic status as like a millionaire's daughter, like protected her from a lot of, like from a lot of these very serious conversations on like race and politics. It's just like, you're just the rich girl who, like, you know, what do you know about suffering? And you're pretty much taking a very famous violent massacre as like just an art project. Like, I feel like getting the calls from like inside the house would have been like a much funnier way,
I guess. But we're also talking in terms of 2008, and the word probably would have been like maybe 2004, 2005 when this art show came out, and the fact that like people don't care as much about Chinese people, like they cared even less about Chinese people back
I had to look this up. You know, do you remember the Met Gala? Like, they had a theme one year, like China through the looking glass.
Yeah.
And yeah. I was just like, when did that come out? And it came out in 2015. So I wonder if Jade, when she was writing like all the art projects that Sina did and just like the art world in general, I'm like, oh, I wonder if she like thought about that on like how.
Yeah.
China was exoticized for this multi-millionaire event. So.
Yeah.
Yeah. Again, I kind of wish Sina was more pretentious with her money and more precious with her art and be kind of really out of touch with politics. And she is, but I just felt like she like leaned more into it. Like, you know, like people who say like, oh yeah, I'm an activist and they don't know anything, you know? So like, I kind of expected her to be that type of artist being like, yeah, I'm going to be like Banksy, but I don't know anything about the issues that Banksy makes art out of. So,
but I think she is kind of like a good like model for what the general Asian American political consciousness was, especially back in like 2015, 2016, which is like, we know a lot about our own issues. We're still learning about our role. Like, because, you know, before 2020 or before like all the Minneapolis protests and all that, like a lot, I feel like a lot of like Asian Americans specifically, you know, didn't really think about like, you know, unless you grew up in LA, you know about like the LA uprisings, like didn't really think about the role of like Asians in like America besides like the American Dream, Model Minority, maybe Vincent Chin, right?
Yeah. Like, yeah. And it is funny because she is an LA kid and like, it's like, I think it really does make sense that she doesn't kind of have like a racial identity crisis because like she grew up in a place where there were like Asians and also people of color in like the majority.
Yeah.
And you know, like, I kind of wish she did grapple with it now that I'm thinking about it. Like, when she's, like, in the East Coast, especially in upstate New York, where there's, like, no Asian people.
I kind of
wish there was, like, more of, like, a, like, it's just, like, okay, what does my Asian identity mean to me now as someone who is not living in an Asian majority city and I don't have money?
But at the same time, because this is where like my experiences kind of dovetail with this, is like, you know, I grew up in the SJV. I grew up amongst Asians. Like, I think something interesting that this book does that not a lot of stories about Asian American immigrants do is like the characters never grapple with their Asian Americanness. They don't spend the entire book like they're coming of age. They all have coming of age, you know, story arcs. But their coming of age is not about like accepting their Asian Americanness. Like the Asian Americanness is like their Chinese Americanness is already part of them. They don't really think about that. And similarly, you know, growing up in the SJV, like I never really thought about like, you know, like for me, what set me apart from my friends is the fact that I was born in Canada, not that I was, you know, Chinese, Taiwanese American. And it wasn't until I moved to the East Coast, like I think it took 2 days, my second day in Maryland, someone asked me where I was really from. And I was like, oh, shit, this really happens.
Oh, this actually happens. Yeah.
But even then, like I didn't like it didn't suddenly like, oh, now I have to worry about my Chineseness. Again, like I don't think about needing to prove it to myself or to other people constantly, right? It's I think it's not like if you didn't grow up with like that complex, it's not something that you develop later on. Like you may develop like some indignities, like I can't believe you asked me that, but it's not like, oh no, now I have to like be self-conscious about being Asian. Like that didn't happen to me when I was in East Coast, and I imagine it's similar to like what happened to Sina too. It's just like you don't suddenly become like, oh, now I have to minimize my Chinese, or at least in my experience. It might be different for other people. But
Well, like, it's not so much like minimalizing. Like, I would think that, you know, coming from an Asian majority city and then moving to New York City, where there are a lot of Asians, but there are a lot of Asians who came from other places where there weren't a lot of Asians.
Yeah.
And in the art world, you know, your ethnicity does play a big factor. And I would have thought that she like maximized that, you know, like really fucking milked it for all it's worth. And she does to a certain extent with like the Tiananmen Square fashion show, but not enough for my opinion. Again, yeah. I kind of wish everyone was more terrible. And that's just me wanting more entertainment out of people's like bigotry.
In my experience though, the biggest thing that I think about when living or when moving to a place that's not as Asian is how crappy the food is here.
Oh no. Yeah, exactly. Like before I went to the East Coast, like before, because like my wedding reception was in like the middle of nowhere in Pennsylvania. Like I kid you not. Like it is like trees everywhere. You do not get signal. That's why like when I was dealing with family stuff and people were trying to contact me, I'm like, I can't. I don't have signal. We're in the middle of nowhere. Before I went on the trip, I was like, I need to get my boba. I need to get like, I need to eat like some good authentic Asian food like before I board that plane, because who knows if we will come across like even a Panda Express over there.
Yeah.
So
yeah, as bad as it is now, it was probably worse in 2008.
It was so much worse in, yeah, yeah. Like that was another thing where when I visited the city, like Manhattan, I was like, dang, there's like so many boba places and so many good Asian eateries and like not even just like Asian fusion places, like literal, like just, oh, wow, this is a house that specializes in dumplings and dumplings only. And I was like, where was all this when I was going to school in like the late 2000s? You know, there was only one boba place that I had to like walk to like quite a ways from my classes. So yeah, totally yeah. Different time period in Asian Americana, but I digress. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. We talked a lot about Sina. We didn't really talk about her relationship with Leo. I thought overall that was just like a pretty, in a lot of ways, by the books, like rom-com setup, right? Meet cute at the farmer's market, breakup scene when the ex comes back, Sina realizes that she's made a huge mistake and goes back to him.
I did not care about Sina's love relationships. In fact, I could have used none of it. Like I just wish it was about her art scandal and her living in upstate New York and just dealing with being the only Asian person there.
Yeah.
And just like her trying to force this Martha Stewart lifestyle that she, you know, like obviously thought would be like her comeback story to the art world. Like I expected so much more of that than the love stories. And I think the love stories really detracted from like her arc.
Yeah.
You know?
I do agree that like it wasn't the most compelling storyline. I much preferred her interactions with her family. Like, you know, they can only talk to each other on cell phone because she's like the only person not on that road trip. And in a lot of ways, she was the functional parent of her younger siblings, right? Like she was definitely parentified as a child. So I thought that was an interesting relationship. But yeah, I the Leo storyline, while I'm happy for them, it wasn't exactly like what I came to this book for.
Yeah,
for sure.
Also, it just kind of seemed like it was like, okay, let's make her date a black guy. Like, oh my goodness, isn't this going to be so shocking to Asian American like family sensibilities because of like anti-black reasons? And I'm like, yes, all true. But also this relationship is kind of bleh for me. Also, Grayson is bleh for me. So I kind of could have used none of that. And I would have liked to see more like Sina's like parentified role, you know?
Yeah.
If I was in her position, and quite frankly, I did get some anxiety reading this book because I do have like similar problems, and it's just like, oh man, this is my worst nightmare. If I was living on the other side of the country from my crazy dysfunctional family, and all of a sudden they're like, oh, so we're gonna live with you, and it's like, how do you deal with that? And yeah, it's just like I felt like I was just kind of missing that eldest daughter, like horror story struggle.
Yeah.
Struggles. So I kind of, yeah, there's a lot of things in Sina's storylines that I would just like could have used more of. And I kind of felt the same way with the other siblings, too, if we want to move on to Andrew and Grace.
Let's start with Andrew. I feel like Grace, we can't talk about Grace without, you know, slapping a trigger warning, right?
Okay, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But let's start with Andrew because I feel like his chapters were definitely like the cringiest. Like I definitely had like nervous laughter through most of it because, you know, he's like a rich but naive and kind of like, I mean, he's kind of a dumbass, right? Like he has a very, I think a lot of people in our Discord, a lot of people were kind of down on him. But, you know, for me, it was like, kid never have a chance, right? Like he, number one, is the middle child. Number two, like his entire identity, like his dream is to become a stand-up comedian, and it seems like he's doing that in a way as a form of rebellion against his father and his dreams for him. And also, like, the fact that, like, so we open, okay, I found it kind of interesting. Like, for most of the book, the only spicy scenes we get are Andrew scenes. But because they're Andrew scenes and because they mostly involve him kind of masturbating, right? They're,
I mean,
kind of
not
icky.
All of the spicy scenes were with Andrew.
Yeah. But I guess he has, like, you know, so his whole thing with, like, love is he has a complex because his dad is such an adulterer. He doesn't want to do it unless he feels love. And that kind of plays into his arc because he essentially has to convince himself he's in love with, like, this older woman that he bits. And I do appreciate that Jade at least made him an adult. Like, he's, you know, 20, at least 21 years old at the time of this, like, story, right? 20, 21 years old. But at the same time, still, like, mentally, I think, immature for, like, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, Andrew is a coddled boy. He's like, oh, my sweet boy, my only son in this Chinese American family that comes from, like, you know, the bourgeoisies before communist China. And it's just like, yeah, I expected Charles to put more expectations on his son because of that traditional value. But I think Jade does a good job subverting a lot of the stereotypes that we see in Asian immigrant literature. I mean, now it's not really subversion because we've read so many books where,
yeah,
like, it's kind of the norm now not to have parents who are like super gender bias. And I mean, in a way, Charles seems to treat his daughters better than his son, but it could also just be Andrew being a middle child, so hard to say.
Also, he's kind of a fail son, right? He's kind of like a fail son before fail sons became like a thing.
Yeah. With Andrew, we're like, I cringe so hard at his like comedy sets, and you know, I didn't mind it because I think about like, oh, okay, like he's a rich boy who never really had any problems. He's conventionally good looking. From like LA Asian boyfriend standards. I don't know if that would like translate well to other towns where there aren't a lot of Asian people. But he like, you know, he kind of glided through life without any problems. So what is he going to be a comedian about? And this reminds me of Atsuko's set recently about how she was just like, if you see any Japanese people who leave Japan, something went really wrong. And she's like, if I stayed in Japan, do you think I would have been a comedian? Like, do you think Japan fosters a good environment, aka trauma, to make a good good comedian? And I'm like, yeah, Andrew is just, you know, he's using the fact that he's Asian and leaning on stereotypes as like his material. And it's not good because it's not coming from, like, he's not.
Yeah, it's not coming from, like, at least what we look for in a good stand-up, right? Like, you know, as someone who has sat through some terrible open mics back in my day, like, it's his bombing in Austin's is on par with, like, some of the worst sets that I've seen. And I remember going to it was a comedy show in San Francisco. And this is actually my first time seeing Shen Wang, who, you know, later on would open for Ali Wong and have his own, like, very successful comedy special. I saw him back in, like, I want to say 2005, like, when he was first starting out. And even then, he was a standout because he was the only comic in this, like, Asian-American comedy showcase that did not, like, do accent humor and did not, like, spend the entire time saying, well, I'm so Chinese, I'm this. And, like, that was kind of, like, in that first set, 90% of Andrew's jokes. And then he resorts to the worst sin in like Asian American comedy, which is like accent humor.
Yeah. But I really did like that scene because I was just like, oh yes, like show how bad he is at comedy. It makes me feel uncomfortable, meaning that like it's actually like really good writing.
It was so uncomfortable, and it felt good. It felt like it's like when you're watching a good like cringe scene in like a comedy, right?
Yeah. And, you know, I'm so glad that when he did his set in New Orleans, like, he blacked out. I didn't have to sit through another one. And then his final set, I forgot where it was.
Was in North Carolina or?
Yeah, like, it was like before he got to upstate New York.
Yeah.
But he does, like, his last set, and, you know, it's like he has a good crowd. They're very generous with their laughs and applause. And he's like, ah, yes, this is what it feels like to be on stage. It's about, like, the ability to be honest without judgment. And, I mean, people are judging, but, like,
yeah,
whatever. But it's just like, I expected more from his set when, because it was like kind of like a redemption scene, right? And I'm like, none of the jokes are landing.
As someone, like, because we've seen really good Asian American stand-up since 2015, 2016, like, I feel like in terms of that, like, you know, it wasn't at the level that, you know, that we're used to, right? But I think in terms of, like, improving and, like, having jokes that come from a more real place, I think he did show growth. Like, I was proud of him for, like, finding a voice and finding a lane that really spoke authentically, as opposed to, like, trying to force jokes from, like, his first two sets.
Yeah. I mean, I, like, his most genuine jokes were him talking about being a virgin and, like, being so glad that he's not a virgin anymore. And I'm like, oh, okay. Yeah. Like, it's not funny to me, but I can see it being, like, an endearing, like, comedic set. But I expected more self-reflection, and I don't know, like, it's supposed to be like, yeah, maybe he's not so bad at comedy after all. And I'm like, no, he's still really bad at comedy, and he should probably, like, take some serious classes, because it bad.
I thought it showed promise. I'd like to see him, like, maybe 5 years from then, like, work on your material. You know, I'm sure he's getting a lot of great material from his trip to China at the end of the book, you know.
Yeah. But also, like, okay, let's talk about him being homeless, or, like, choosing to be homeless.
Yeah, well, we can't talk about that without his initial decision to become, like, to leave his family for this woman he met in a night and somehow got talked to having sex with. And, you know, because of his complex stuff, like, I have to have sex with the person I love, he convinces himself that he's in love with her. And that's why he has to stay, to take responsibility. And the entire time I was like, oh. I mean, it's dumbassery that's to character, but still doesn't make it less of, like, a, just a overall, like, even their father's friend Nash, who they're staying with, is like, this is a bad idea, son. Like, yeah, you shouldn't do this.
But, yeah, like, I did feel bad that he had to kind of gaslight himself into thinking he was in love with Dory in order to be like, okay, yeah, like, my first time having sex, it actually means something. I actually have an emotional connection with this person. So it's okay that, you know, I'm having sex with her. And I'm like, yeah, it is kind of fucked up that you have to gaslight yourself into thinking that way, because sex is sex and you shouldn't shame yourself for it. But yeah, like, after that relationship falls through, he's like, yeah, I'm not going to go to Uncle Nass's house. I'm just going to sleep on benches and eat donuts. And I'm just like, why don't you have... I mean, it sounded like he had cash, not a lot, but he had enough cash to, like, probably crash at a hostel. This is New Orleans. Like, they have hostels. They have, like, really cheap hotels. It's a big tourist town. So I don't know. Just, like, him purposely picking that. I mean, that is, like, classic rich person move, being like, oh, I wonder what it feels like to be poor. But I just feel like he had a good time, kind of. Like, he didn't have a hard enough time as a homeless person.
Rich person, rich boy, Delulu, deluding himself. Like, the type of person who could delude themselves into thinking they're good at stand-up is the type of person who would, like, you know, maybe it's also part toxic. Like, I can't admit that I made a mistake and now I have to live with it. But yeah, I do agree. He did have a really good time as a homeless person. And I think, yeah, I mean, for me, I read it as, like, this is kind of like, when you take away the wealth, right? And not really, because, you, like you mentioned, he still has cash. He still has means. But when you take away the comforts of like being a rich kid. He's pretty like easygoing in general, right? He's like, he's kind of just, he's okay with drifting. He's okay with like taking the hard road. And I thought that was interesting. Like he's the type of person who sees the bright side and everything. And maybe that's part of his role as middle child, to be kind of the peacekeeper.
Yeah, but it needs to come crashing down at some point, you know? I feel like by day three, he should have been like very haggard and be like, oh, actually being strapped for cash is not fun. I thought it was bad when my Range Rover got repossessed, but this is pretty bad. Like, I expected more of like a fallout. And, you know, this is like before they went on this family road trip. But one of my favorite scenes in this book was the econ class. Like, yeah, that was great.
Yeah, I mean, it does a good job setting the scene, right? 2008, at this point, if you're reading a book today in 2025 and you are, you know, younger, like under 30, let's say, you probably don't really have a good sense of what exactly happened in 2008. And so they did a really good job kind of giving an overview of like what exactly happened. And this is actually we talked about this a lot in Discord, which is like the fact that like, okay, the family loses everything during the 2008 financial crisis, but not because of like what you would think, right? It's not because they over-speculated on land or they bought too many houses and had to foreclose. They were like a casualty of the 2008 financial crisis. And in a way, it's like, it's not exactly Charles's fault. Partly is. Like Charles, you know, his ambition could not allow him to remain the maker of things that make things. He wants to make the things. He wanted to start his own line. He wanted to expand his business and like become like the biggest brand, right? Become a brand in itself. But in order to do that, he had to gather more capital. And it just so happened that the banker that he used to work with retired. And this new guy that he has to work with is kind of racist. Maybe not kind of, that's very racist, right? Who like has no faith in Charles as a person, has no faith in his business acumen, and is not willing to make a deal. And Charles, as like the crude, ambitious, and just very like emotional man he is, decides to like put everything down as collateral to finance this loan, because in his mind he could not lose, right? And then what happened was the financial crisis happened, drove up interest rates, and basically he had to default on his loans. But our book club members on Discord made a really good point that like at the same time, these banks were giving out subprime mortgages to people who obviously could not afford them for little to nothing down, right? Because that was their incentive. They were incentivized to write these bad loans, but they had no incentive to like give Charles a ostensibly would be a good loan because of his track record, and that causes the family's downfall.
Yeah. It is like a good commentary on Charles's hubris, because it's like you could still be rich. You could have been unscathed, like relatively unscathed by this economic crash, but you decided to put everything down as collateral, including your home, your children's education. Like it's definitely a gambler's mindset. And I have seen this mindset in a lot of Asian men who are also in like middle to like lower class as well. It's just like this idea that like, oh, I can finally like, I because before big. For Charles, it's like he's been very lucky, you know, so he kind of has like confirmation bias. And then that's the difference with like Asian men in middle and lower classes who, you know, don't have that track record, and they're like, oh, if I will win eventually. Like, yeah. So it's a little bit of a different gambler mindset. But
there's that, and also just his emotional response that like, you're not gonna give me a loan because I'm Chinese, so I'll prove to you, because there's no way I'd lose, right? There's that very like kind of Asian American chip on his shoulder that also drives him to make this bad decision. It's but I thought it was really interesting that like the family's downfall has nothing to do with the housing market, but like the after effects, the effects of the housing market on everything else.
Yeah. Yeah. Really, my worst nightmare as the eldest daughter of an entrepreneur who also has like very big ambitions. And it's like, if my dad did this to me, I would be so, like, I would just cut off all ties. Like, and this, like, I'm speaking as someone who does have, like, assets with my dad's company and is, like, personally tied to, like, his company finance. And it's like, yeah, if he fucking did that to me, I would fucking ruin him. Like it's, I feel like his kids are way too cool.
Yeah, like that scene.
Losing that much.
Yeah, like that scene where Sina finds out that even her trust is like not safe, that there's a lien on her trust that's supposed to be her money. But that was included in like the collateral assets. It's like pretty, yeah. She was a little too cool about that for sure.
Yeah. And her being like, well, I have my own income. I was like, as what? As a washed up gallery? Like, you're not even doing normal gallery showings. Like, you haven't sold a piece of work in forever. Like, but the fact that she doesn't have a mortgage on her upstate house, I'm like, well, there's small blessings.
I mean, she also probably inherited her father's hubris, too, because she definitely thinks that she's still got it. Right?
I did find it really funny that Grace, like, didn't believe it. She's like, everything is a test. I will get my $7 million.
She thought
once
it was
I
like the game.
25.
She thought it was like the game from Michael Douglas. Yeah, let's talk about Grace. So I guess this is where I don't know how much we'll dwell on it, but her story does involve some, like, you know,
suicidal ideation.
Yeah. So just a quick trigger warning for people who might be sensitive to those topics. I'll throw some timestamps on the show notes so you know when to come back. After we discuss that stuff. But what did you think about Grace's character? I feel like she, overall, I think her arc is the most shortest. We're with her for a lot of the trip, but we don't spend a lot of time. Like her arc is much more internal, right? Like, we first meet her when they go to pick her up from her boarding school. So right away, like, the fact that she got sent to, so she at the beginning of the story is at a boarding school in Santa Barbara that her father sent her to because, if I read it correctly, because she got involved with the boy at school, right? He freaked out.
Yeah.
And I guess her character trait at the beginning is like, she has a macabre fascination with like young death and suicides. Right. Like, that's kind of like, that's how she decorated her dorm wall and things like that. I know this is a sensitive topic for you, Rira. So I'm curious, like, what, like, your thoughts on that whole thing is.
Yeah. So I was looking back and I was like, oh, okay, Grace is like around 15 years old. This is around the time when my suicidal ideation was at its highest, or it was going to go a little bit higher, but it was pretty high at the time. And, I don't know. Like, I feel like teenagers at that age are, you know, life seems like it just, you're just fascinated by people who live their life fast and, you know, like live their life to the fullest and then died young. Like, there is like this obsession with that around that age. And if you didn't grow up with that obsession, good for you. You were maybe well adjusted to society. But, I did feel kind of like I did see a lot of myself in her, of just like, okay, like, where do I belong? Like, I don't seem to belong to my family. Like, I don't seem to belong at this school. Like, despite being a rich kid, she doesn't seem to have a lot of meaningful connections with her classmates. So it does make sense that she gravitates towards, you know, like historical figures who are also outsiders, who, you know, are more prone to having suicidal ideations. So it's just like, I can see it. And it does make sense because her mother died in this freak helicopter incident. Which is kind of weird to read after Kobe Bryant's helicopter death.
Yeah. I didn't even think about that. That's true.
You didn't even think about that?
Yeah. I just thought it was just like, wow, like, what a wild way to go. And the fact that, like, Charles survived because he wasn't wearing a seatbelt, right? Like, it's just the improbable nature of it. And the fact that, like, they were on that trip to try to rekindle their romance. And, you know, Charles is a terrible person. We, you know, we
He was already thinking about divorce. Yeah.
And I think that was also like a big part of like, she is a character who like is sheltered, not only because of her privilege, but also like because her family shelters her, right? They don't talk about her dead mother, who she never got to know. And so all she has is like this photograph of like her last moments. And like, and I think it does make sense that she develops like this, this fascination with like
being young forever.
Yeah. Right. But I think it was like meant to be uncomfortable, right? Like it obviously made her roommate very uncomfortable too. I think, yeah. And her arc kind of closes at the beginning of the third act of the book, where when the family gets into that car accident, and then RIP station wagon, you did a good job, you were a good girl. But like she kind of comes to the realization that like actually she wants to live, right? Actually she didn't want to die.
Yeah. And I think this was kind of a similar experience to me. I didn't get into like a fucking car crash, but I've had like near death experiences, and you know, it like proved to me every single time. I'm like, okay, as depressed as I am, which I do need to get like serious help for, there's still a small part of me that thinks that life is worth living, and it means that I should still give it a try. So to see her like kind of have that realization of just like, okay, like I didn't want to die. And like, what does that mean for me? Like, I'm just like, okay, yeah. That is, I feel like that is like a very authentic response to a near death experience. I know some people probably thought like, oh, that's like a quick 180, like what the hell? And I'm like, no, I feel like when you're that young and you're that, you know, fascinated by like suicide, yeah, like I feel like that is like a valid reaction.
Yeah.
I did like Grace's relationship with her siblings. I do like how like her and Andrew have like their inside jokes and play games to make fun of Barbara, which I was like, that's not fair. Like, I think Barbara was my favorite character.
I liked her
enough.
Too. Yeah. I know. I think our Discord's a little mixed on Barbara, but I thought she was like, I don't think she did anything wrong.
Yeah,
like,
same here.
I think she was just following what she wanted. And I know some people were kind of, there was a comment on Discord kind of questioning the point of her in the story and her like reconciliation with Charles at the end. But I feel like that was actually kind of a sweet moment, because like Charles' relationship with the kid's mom, Maylee, was all artifice, right? She was the trophy wife. She was like the beautiful Asian American woman that he was supposed to marry. And was supposed to become like his proof of his success. But the fact that he still had Barbara's school ID from when they first met in school kind of showed that like they had something real before any of the wealth came into the situation. And the
yeah,
fact that
I really like that too.
Yeah. And the fact that they found each other at the end was nice for both of them. Like she was someone who, you know, saw a chance to be with like essentially with the man that she actually loved and took it and had to put up with being a stepmom and did her best, right? She did her best not to overstep, not to like kind of take the place of their mother. And that might be her only like kind of misstep of not building a relationship with the children. But at the same time, the children didn't seem like they wanted to build a relationship with her neither, right? Because
I was surprised that she didn't form a closer bond with Grace, who was an infant at this time. So yeah. I would have thought that she, you know, would have treated Grace like her own baby. But
I'm sure the parentified Sina would have been like,
oh yeah, except Sina really, yeah. I mean, Sina and Grace have a 10-year age gap,
yeah.
So I can see that being like a really big barrier for Barbara to get close to Grace. And, you know, like a lot of people can say they don't like Barbara because she's selfish. She like stole money from her poor immigrant, not immigrant because she was still in Taiwan, but like her poor Asian parents and you know, like she went after this man after he lost his wife. Like, it's just like, wow, she's so cutthroat. She's a gold digger. She only cares about money. But I like seeing selfish women because I feel like a lot of the times women in real life and also in fictional life, they always have to put other people's needs before their own. So there's something really admirable about seeing a woman who is just like, no, I'm going to take what I can take in order to get what I want. And I do love how, you know, she knows that she's not conventionally attractive. And she's like, okay, what is the best way to get respect? It's to wield money in a sophisticated manner, not like a nouveau rich way. Because it seems like she kind of knew how to behave with other rich people to a point where it was like not gauche.
Yeah.
And yeah, it was just like, okay, there is like, there, like her adaptability is like really admirable to me. And I just really like that scene where she's like, you know what? I can start over. I like, like I can leave this family. This family doesn't give a shit about me. And she like puts on her makeup and, you know, it's like, you know, a great way to show how, you know, makeup is kind of like armor for particularly women, how to like transform oneself and how like Charles was a founder of like a makeup company. So it's like, oh, maybe you are more compatible with Charles than you think. And I just like love the moment where she's like fully, you know, done up and she's like, okay, it's time to go. And she can't do it. And it's like, okay, like, so she's proving everyone wrong. She's not just a gold digger. Like, there's actual affection for Charles in this family. So, yeah, I really like Barbara. She was my favorite character.
Yeah. All right. So we've talked about, I think we talked about all the family members at this point. Any stop on the road trip that was particularly interesting? I personally really liked the interlude in New Orleans when they met with their old family friend, Nash, who is like this, like, Southern gentleman with like a China fetish. He's a cinephile, right? Or sinophile. You know, I love that they met him when they were neighbors in Monterey Park. And that his story kind of like, I love that it paralleled with Charles's story, which is like he moved back to New Orleans to kind of salvage or reclaim his family legacy, his family land. In the same way that Charles is trying to, you know, go and recover his family land.
Yeah, but it's kind of like a broken promise, you know, because yeah. It's like, you know, like Nash's like family, they were the landed gentry. But then, you know, as time went on, it's like, yeah, like those upper aristocrats have just like degraded because they had like no form of income other than, you know, slavery and like taxes from their tenants. So it's like. Yeah, like this world that you're dreaming of, it's gone. And it's the same with Charles when he goes to China. It's like,
yeah,
it's not there. It's not that. Also, like, didn't Charles live in Taiwan? So, like, the China he's dreaming of is like two generations removed. Yeah.
One generation removed, I think. It's based on his father's stories of like the old land that, like, because he is like the oldest son of that landowning family. So technically it is his birthright if he never left. But if he had never left, he also would have been targeted by, you know, the Red Guard during the Cultural Revolution. I like Nash's part, especially because I listened to this part on audiobook. So all of Nash's lines were spoken in just a very comforting Louisiana drawl. But I love that like, I feel like Nash is more up to date with the way China is and the real, like, what the way China is, as opposed to Charles's, like, romanticized version of China. And so their conversation is really interesting as, like, you know, like, different viewpoints of the same place. And they do mention in the book, like, yeah, like, at some point they just have to agree that, like, the China that, like, there are multiple Chinas. Just, like, there's multiple Charles's, multiple everyone. Like, it's a multiverse of people.
Yeah. I did not expect Charles to just kind of dip out and like go to China. I was like, whoa. It's like, it's kind of late in the book. So I was pretty surprised. I was like, there's like 50 pages. Like, what can happen in 50 pages?
I was surprised too, because I did notice in the table of contents that the last few chapters did take place in China. So I know that they go there eventually, but the fact that like he like dips out right when they get to New York. But it's also to character, because as we know, Charles is a very impulsive, emotional man.
And I just like the scene where he gets out of the airport and he's like, wow, this is different. This is not the China I expected. It is.
It reminded me of when TikTok shut down for that brief, like, you know, like that brief time everyone moved to like that Chinese app and suddenly discovered that China is actually like a developed country with a lot of infrastructure and like government amenities. It reminded me of that. Like, that was like last year, right? That was like very recent when like everyone kind of discovered.
That wasn't even last year. That was this year. That was back in January.
Felt like a year ago. Jeez.
Yeah, he's just like, oh, like, look at all these people who have tailored clothes and, you know, have like real gold watches. Like, this could have been me if I stayed. And I'm like, no, it wouldn't. You would have died.
Yeah, you have been sent to a work
communism.
Camp.
Yeah. Yeah. And I guess like there's like the whole like his superiority view on just like, oh, look at all these peasants who are now dressed up as if they are part of the upper class. They're still peasants.
It definitely has a very like supremacist view on the world. Like, and I wouldn't say like, at first it felt like he was like a Han supremacist type, like, oh, it's all about Chinese bloodline. But the fact that he's like in love with Barbara kind of like, she's okay, at least he's not like racist Chinese. He's racist for sure. He has some like kind of classically racist view, but he's not the extreme of that. He's maybe like,
yeah, his comments on Taiwan was not like, I'm just like, yeah. I don't know. Like, it's like Taiwan is not Chinese until it's like convenient for him to call them Chinese. And it's like, I don't know about that, man.
I did like the sequence where, and I think maybe, you know, he does suffer a series of strokes in China. And so there's a scene where he finally gets to his family's land and he has like an emotional response to it. And like, during that time, I was like, is he having a stroke at this point? Because it sounds like he's like on something right now.
Yeah, I thought he was having a stroke.
Yeah.
Then too.
He probably was, to be honest. But he has this very like...
He definitely had a stroke after he saw the sign saying like, oh,
we're building apartments
here. Like, this is an apartment complex now.
Yeah, we find out that, yeah, like the land does exist and it did belong to him. But a relative pretended to be him. Got the deed to land and sold it to debt collectors to finance his own gambling.
Gambling addiction.
Yeah.
Yeah. Again, like, with the gambling.
Yeah. Which it was sad. I felt bad for him, but at the same time, it was a little poetic, right? It rhymed with his own downfall, which is like, in a sense, he was done in by hubris that apparently runs in the Wang family men.
Yeah. And I don't know. There's something really satisfying of like seeing a rich guy who lost it all and he still has like this entitlement of like, oh, like I might have lost everything in America, but like my family land, the riches in China, I'm owed that as the eldest son. And I'm like, no, you're not. You're not owed shit. Okay. Like, as someone who is like very anti-capitalist, I'm just like, no.
Like, yeah.
you ain't owed shit. Like, you're a bad person. I mean, like, I don't know what else to say. It's just, I'm just like, yeah, like, it. Good on you for not getting anything from this trip. Oh my god!
But also,
like, I'm just thinking about how he drove all the way to New York and flew all the way to Beijing.
Like, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, good on you for not getting anything, but also good on you for not giving up. I think that is like his most endearing trait, is like his endless optimism that things will work out, right? Like, there, things will always work out, because of course it comes from a very narcissistic place where it's like things will work out because I cannot be allowed to fail. Like, I cannot fail.
Very right? Like main character energy. You know? Yeah. It's like, I have plot armor. And I'm like, no, you don't.
But maybe it does. We can talk about the last scene in a little bit.
Yeah, the ending. I know people on Discord was asking about our thoughts on the ending and like what it meant. What about you, Marvin? Like, so, what are your thoughts on it?
Yeah, the final scene, the whole family comes to China and Charles suffers another, I guess, mini stroke. And I think, so this is where the book gets its most, I guess, metaphorical, because we kind of mm-hmm. like go through like his like stream of consciousness as he's like maybe dying while having a stroke and like trying to get his last words out. I don't think he dies, but his last words are, "Daddy discovered America," which is open to interpretation what that means. To me, I feel like how you mentioned that, like, yeah, he went back to China to like find essentially his birthright, right? To like kind of reclaim what he has lost, and then realizing that there's nothing there. And throughout his like hallucinations during his stroke, he kind of comes to terms with like, I'm also American now. America is also my country. And so I just have to reclaim my birthright, because he comes to the epiphany that like the first people to step foot on the American continent were from China. And so essentially I am also American, right? And so I think it's kind of, to me, it feels like this is him accepting the American part of his and his family's identity. And I guess making the statement that because his success in America belongs to him, much like the family land in China belonged to him throughout the story, he also deserves to get back everything that he lost in America. Kind of like committing to pulling himself back up on his bootstraps, right? Like, the Wang family is not done yet.
Yeah, I can see that. For me, it was more like he's realizing that, you know, he did good, that he achieved the American dream. And like, you know, like, even though he lost everything, he's like, you know, he has his family, and he realizes that, you know, they are like the most important things in his life, because he like says like very loving things to his kids, like on what he assumes is his deathbed. And I think it's just like, yeah, like, I had a good life even when I lost everything. So that was kind of what I thought, like, Daddy discovered America to be. Being yeah. like, yeah, I finally made it. And it's okay.
I can
okay.
see that. Yeah.
And also just like him beseeching Andrew to tell him, like, what was the name of the Viking who actually discovered America and not Christopher Columbus? Because Christopher Columbus was a thief and a liar.
That was good.
Yeah, that was good. That was good. Yeah. Especially since, like, early on, like, you know, he's talking about how, like, he's very generous with his holidays to his employees. But Columbus Day, everyone works. Like, fuck that guy. And I'm like, yeah you're
agree.
Right. Fuck that guy.
In this I aspect, I am on Charles's team.
Yeah. But, yeah, I mean, it's not clear whether he dies or he survives, but I don't think that's the point. The point is he has reached the destination that he... Like that he was looking for, whatever that is.
Whatever that is. And that, you know, the spirit of the Wang family lives on, for better or worse. Like, I don't know if we're better for it. Probably not. But, you know, I think Gracie will come out of it ahead. Like, I feel like she has a good head on her shoulders. I feel like she probably becomes the first, you know, fashion influencer in the age of YouTube. And, you know, I feel like, you know, in a way, that's kind of the gateway to Asian American, quote unquote, stardom in the aughts, right? In the 2010s.
Yeah, she's like, she's like the new Gen M, and like, yeah.
All right. Well, I guess with that'll do it for our discussion of The Wangs Versus the World by Jay Chang. A couple of our book club members did ask us about our thoughts on like, what do we think we were supposed to have learned from undergoing this journey with The Wangs, and also what points, lessons, or reflections, if any, is she making about the Asian American experience? I think we covered a lot of that in our discussion, but
yeah,
in the end, I think the most endearing trait that the Wang family like exudes is like they're just tenacity, I guess. Again, for better or worse, they're a very tenacious family. They're ambitious, they have a lot of hubris, but they don't give up on their dreams or each other. You know, again, for better or worse, like, I don't know if we're better for Andrew to continue on his quest to becoming a standard comic. I don't know if we're better that Sina is going to continue like her art projects, but the fact that like they have not given up on the American dream, I think is kind of the lasting impression.
Yeah. I mean, these kids still have grit, yeah, even though they grew up in luxury.
Yeah.
So there's that. Like I said, this book came out in 2016, and I do wonder what my reaction would have been if I had finished it in 2016 before we read our catalog of Asian immigrant stories that subvert stereotypes, because this book was really lauded for, you know, turning Asian stereotypes on its head, being like, oh yeah, like a rich family that loses everything, because we're so used to immigrants like rising up and like, yeah, gaining success. And it's like, okay, but I've seen the story so many times now since 2016. So I do wonder what I would have thought.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's definitely an artifact of its time. And I can see why people really enjoyed. We really thought it was something special back in 2016. I still really enjoyed it as like a road trip comedy movie about rich people lose everything. And it was still refreshing that it was about like a nouveau riche family and not like old money family. Because I think I feel like we got like an avalanche of those stories after 2018 for sure.
Yeah, final criticisms. I wish there was more commentary on just like how much their wealth has sheltered them from like racial discrimination, and yeah, how like you know, if you have enough money you can rise above like racism in a way. And like I would have liked to seen their downfall in that, and just kind of see like how other Asian people who are not so lucky in their economic situations and being like, oh, this is how like normal Asian people live, like, okay. Like I kind of wish I saw more of that. I kind of wish everyone was more awful than they were portrayed to be, just so that there was like more I guess like more of like more growth towards the end, you know. I wish the humor resonated with me more. Like sometimes I just found it like really crass in a way where I'm like, is this really necessary? Do I really need to see Charles like peeing all over his ancestral land? Like, do I really need to read about Andrew's like masturbation? And just, yeah, there was a lot of like crass humor where I'm like, I don't think this is necessary. So it didn't really stick with me. But yeah, like, I did not like this book, but I still said some pretty good things about it. So read it if you guys are curious about your own thoughts.
Yeah.
Make your own opinions.
And I think I came out, I really liked this story. I think in terms of like, I'm a big fan of the classic road trip movie, Road Trip, which is a lot of gross out humor. So I think that kind of, I don't know if that was what Jay was going for, but definitely like I was okay with the crassness, especially because it was part of the character. I think that's something that I still enjoyed about this book even now. It's like this type of story, it's still doing things that, like, even though we've read a lot of Asian American books, this book still does a lot of things that we don't see enough of, right? And Foreign FOMOs is like portraying Asian Americans where the story is not about them finding their Asian American identity. Like that isn't part of any of their journeys. And I think that's kind of refreshing, because that's still not something that we get as much, especially in like today's media, right? You know, the fact that this book came out in 2016 was already telling a story with these types of characters, with this type of, like, you know, with who are comfortable in their identity, I think it wasn't still a cool thing to see. But yeah, definitely like not for everybody, but I really enjoyed it. So, yeah, interested to hear everyone's thoughts, and you know, please let us know what you think, what you thought of the book and our discussion, either on Discord or on Goodreads. We always love to hear your feedback on our book club episodes. But yeah, I guess with that, that'll do it for our discussion of The Wangs vs. the World by Jay Chang. Before we go, Rira, do we have a book club pick for September?
Yes. So September is my pick, and I am picking A Witch's Guide to Magical Innkeeping by Sangu Mandana, who is the author of The Very Secret Society of Irregular Witches, which, you know, we did an author talk on. And it is a whimsical and heartwarming novel about a witch who has a second chance to get her magical powers and her life back on track while she is running an inn. And I'm like, this, it's perfect for fall, in my opinion. You know, it, like, I just very like pumpkin spice latte, you know?
Yeah, it's definitely giving fall, which is ironic because fall doesn't exist in LA in September. Until like at least November. But I do appreciate, you know, there's, it's fall somewhere, and this book is perfect for that. And it's a, I think it's a good like pre-spooky read too. Like it's good, good like supernatural cozy before we like read something unsettling in October.
Yeah. And also, you know, Sangu Mandana, she is an Indian British author, so I'm like, yay, that, like, we haven't seen that in our book club picks in a while.
That's true. We've been
a British author and B someone of Indian descent. Yeah. It's been a while. I try to mix things up when I can, so yeah,
excited to get into this book with all of you. Remember to check out Discord or Patreon for our reading schedule, and thanks for hanging with us on their discussion of our August book club pick. We'll see y'all next time. Bye, everybody.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to Books and Boba. This podcast was hosted by Marvin Yue and Rira Yu, and edited and produced by Marvin Yue. Follow the book club on Twitter and Instagram by going to @booksandboba, and engage with us on Goodreads on our Goodreads group. You can also check out past episodes of the podcast by going to booksandboba.com and by subscribing to us on your favorite podcast app. Don't forget, you can support Books and Boba and Asian American authors by purchasing books at our bookshop.org account. Check out the link in our show notes and also at booksandboba.com. Books and Boba is a proud member of the Potluck Podcast Collective, a collective of Asian American hosted podcasts featuring unique voices and stories from the Asian diaspora. Learn more about the collective and check out our fellow Potluck shows by visiting the website podcastpotluck.com. Thanks for listening.
Hey, sports fans. Welcome to Asians in Hockey. You may not realize it, but there's a rich history of Asians and AAPI folks who have contributed to the legacy of the greatest game on ice. From classic legends like Julie Chu and Robin Bawa, to current greats like Leah Lum and Nick Suzuki, and even rising stars like Akane Shiga and Jason Robertson. We'll cover their stories, celebrate their accomplishments, and learn about their impact on the sport of hockey. I'm Nate Nakao, former beer league player, occasional youth hockey coach, and longtime hockey fan, and I'll be your host as we take a look at the rise of Asians in hockey. Subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Pocket Casts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Part of the Potluck Podcast Collective.
Great news! The Korean Drama Podcast is back for our sixth season.
The Korean Drama Podcast is the podcast about watching Korean dramas by people who don't watch Korean dramas. Hosted by Candace, Jane, and me, Kim.
Wait, if it's our sixth season, can we still say we're people who don't watch Korean dramas?
I'm sure it's fine. Let's just call it character development, which we love in K-dramas.
For our new season, we're recapping the hit 2025 romantic fantasy series Heavenly Ever After, about an elderly couple who reunite in the afterlife, only he's now in his 30s while she's chosen to appear in her 80s.
Awkward.
So join us each week as we discuss the highs and lows of the afterlife in Heavenly Ever After, episode by episode.
Part of the Potluck Podcast Collective.